Spider-Man and about 5,000 other Marvel categories. Disney is buying Marvel Entertainment for $4 billion in cash and stock. The deal must still be approved by Marvel stockholders and federal antitrust regulators. Analysts say Disney is trying to appeal to young men who flock to theaters to see movies based on comic books, such as The Fantastic Four and X-Men. Space Shuttle Discovery docked with the International Space Station last night. It's delivering lab equipment, supplies, and some genetically altered mice for part of a study on bone loss. Discovery is also bringing a new crew member for the space station, Nicole Scott, who will take over as flight engineer. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. Blood donation takes only 45 minutes and saves lives. Donation information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Music Shop and Pro Sound Center, now in their new location at 27 East Market View Drive in Market View Plaza, Champaign. The Music Shop offers private lessons on all instruments in their brand new studios. They also provide a complete band and orchestra instrument repair and service department.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning on the show, the programs are devoted to discussion of the lives of two individuals very important in the history of modern Russia. We have one archive and one new program. In the second hour, we'll be talking live with Bertrand Patenaude. He's the author of a new book that looks at the life of Leon Trotsky, particularly the last couple of years of his life when he was living in exile in Mexico. The book is Trotsky, Downfall of a Revolutionary. That's a new show. We will be taking calls. We'll start things off here with a program from the archives, and this is a program about Nikita Khrushchev and a visit that he made 50 years ago to the United States. This is a program that we first broadcast on the 7th of July, and as you listen to this first hour, keep in mind that we'll not be taking calls. 50 years ago, Nikita Khrushchev came to the United States for a visit. At the time, it was the height of the Cold War, and he was the premier of the Soviet Union, America's great enemy. He was the guy who had his finger on the nuclear button. There are some people here in the United States who thought when he got here, we should simply assassinate him. But there were others who believed that this was a great opportunity to show him the real America. In the process, what we get is, in the words of our guest, one of the most bizarre diplomatic journeys in history. Our guest for this morning is Peter Carlson. He's former reporter and feature writer for the Washington Post, and he is the author of a newly published book. The title of the book is K Blows Top, the subtitle A Cold War Comic Interlude Starring Nikita Khrushchev, America's Most Unlikely Tourist. Public Affairs Books is the publisher. A little bit more about our guest. In addition to his working for the Washington Post, he's been a reporter for the Boston Herald American, where he wrote about local politicians and minor league ball players. And he also was a senior writer for People magazine. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Carlson, hello.
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. And yourself?
I'm fine.
Good. Well, thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. Just maybe to start out here, I want to mention right at the beginning that the title of the book, K Blows Top, was an actual newspaper headline from the time. What was Mr. K so upset about?
Well, it's actually one-third of a newspaper headline. The rest of it was denied tour of Disneyland, K Blows Top. So that tells you what he was upset about. What happened is he was in Hollywood, and he'd arranged to go to a luncheon with the stars at 20th Century Fox, and he was doing pretty well there until they informed him that his scheduled trip to Disneyland that afternoon was being canceled because the local police were afraid they couldn't properly protect him there. And Khrushchev was great at throwing temper tantrums and great at waiting a long time before he blew his stack, and he delivered a very funny speech and had a lot of banter with the audience, and then proceeded to blow his stack over the fact that he wasn't allowed to go to Disneyland. He said, "What? Is there an outbreak of cholera there?" Have gangsters taken over?
Said, are you launching missiles from there or something?
You're right.
Yeah. Well, you know, in thinking about this, to try to get people in the right frame of mind to think about just what this meant, I'm thinking, well, what would be a kind of a parallel sort of example to set up? And the first thing that I thought of was, well, let's suppose that, oh, for example, President Obama invites Kim Jong-il over to the White House and to Camp David and to take a little trip around the country. And then I thought, well, that might be a little bit over the top, but I was delighted to read the piece actually you wrote. I stumbled across it for the Post, setting that up as a kind of alternative or parallel sort of visit.
It would be similar because both men were communist dictators, of course, and both had been rattling their nukes and making vague threats and scaring their neighbors. And it's funny, when I wrote that piece, it was kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing, but I got from the blogging community pretty much the same reaction that Eisenhower got when he invited Khrushchev here 50 years ago, which is that many, many people on the right eviscerated him for this, saying, you know, this guy's a murderer, this guy's a dictator, he's no good, why are we inviting him here? That's the same reaction I got when I suggested that maybe we should invite Kim Jong-il. Mm. So I guess some things don't change.
And I guess that at the time, that is, when Khrushchev was here and Eisenhower was president, that some people genuinely did say, well, we should just take the opportunity to shoot the guy while he's here. And people actually contacted the government, and they apparently had some novel suggestions about ways that we could liquidate the premier.
They did. A doctor from somewhere in the Midwest suggested some radioactive way to kill him. And it was so frightening to the officials who got the letter that he wrote that they placed him under protective custody for the duration of the trip. And J. Edgar Hoover told Congress that he estimated that 25,000 people in America wanted to kill Khrushchev. So they got very, very frightened about his security. And they got even more frightened when they had a security meeting with Khrushchev's chief aides in charge of security, which I learned about when I dug up a document from the National Archives detailing this meeting. It went on for quite some time, and they asked about all of the different ways he would be protected and wanted all the details. And then at the end, one of the Russians turns to the other and says something in Russian, and the other one says, the general says, you know, if anything happens to Premier Khrushchev, it's the end of all of us. And the Americans said, like, well, yeah, of course, that's why we're taking all these precautions. You know, we're doing all we can. And the Russian said, you don't understand. If anything happens to Premier Khrushchev, and then he mimed the act of a bomb falling from the sky and hitting the tabletop there and a mushroom cloud coming up, and he said, boom. So that kind of scared the State Department.
I you would think that it would.
Yeah.
This is something that you have been working on. Apparently, you've been collecting material related to the story for some time. What was it that got you interested in this particular chapter in U.S.-Soviet relations?
Well, it was kind of a weird thing. I used to work at People magazine back in the mid-1980s. And I was a rewrite man, so I had to work very hard on Mondays and Tuesdays, and sometimes Wednesdays, but didn't have really much to do the rest of the week. So I would amuse myself by calling up clippings from the Time Life library, which had great clipping service on anyone who'd been around since Time magazine had been founded in 1923. So one day I had read somewhere that Khrushchev wasn't allowed to go to Disneyland, and I thought to myself, oh, that can't possibly be true. So I called the library and said, could you please send me the clippings on Khrushchev's 1959 tour of the United States? And they said, sure. And they called back a few minutes later and said, you know, there's a real lot of them. You sure you want them all? And I said, sure, send them up. And there were a real lot of them. He was here for 15 days, and there were at least one or more big fat folders on each day. And I opened the first one and dumped it out on my desk and started reading, and it was so bizarre. The events were so weird and funny and scary that I kind of got hooked and started gathering material about it. Of course, I haven't spent the last 25 years doing that exclusively, but periodically I would.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Peter Carlson. He's former reporter and feature writer for the Washington Post, and the book that we're talking about is his book is just out, K Blows Top is the title, and it's published by Public Affairs, and it is about the visit that Nikita Khrushchev made to the United States 50 years ago. It would be 50 years ago in September. He spent 2 weeks here touring the country, and it's a great story, so you might want to look at the book. And questions welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the strange features of the story is that it came about kind of by accident, or maybe that it was an oversight, or maybe you would just say somebody really dropped the ball here, because President Eisenhower did indeed invite Khrushchev to come, but he put a qualification on it. Unfortunately, that didn't get delivered to Mr. Khrushchev.
Yes, it was a bit of a screw-up on the part of one of Ike's State Department aides, a guy by the name of Robert Murphy. Eisenhower was in his last year in office, and he wanted peace. And Khrushchev had been making a lot of threats to West Berlin, which, of course, was a Western enclave in the middle of communist East Germany. And Khrushchev kept periodically threatening it. So there were talks going on at Geneva between officials of the Soviet Union and the Western powers that occupied Berlin, the United States, France, and Britain. But they weren't going anywhere, and Ike really wanted some progress. So he wrote a letter inviting Khrushchev to the United States, and Murphy was supposed to deliver it to a Soviet official who was traveling in the United States. And he did, but he was instructed to tell the Soviet official that there were strings attached, and the string was if there was a treaty signed in Geneva, or at least progress made toward that, then this invitation would take effect. But Murphy didn't quite get that message, so he forgot to report that part of it. So when the Soviet aide took it to Khrushchev, there were no strings attached. There was just a letter from Ike inviting Khrushchev here. And Khrushchev, who loved to travel, was thrilled. He had been hinting that he wanted to come to the United States. So he was thrilled, and he sent a letter back to Eisenhower saying, sure, I'll come and meet with you at Camp David, and how about if I traveled around your country for a period of 10 to 15 days? And Ike was sort of trapped, and he couldn't, like, uninvite Khrushchev. So that's how the trip happened. Mr. Murphy got an earful of Ike's ire at a meeting at the White House, but by then the damage was done.
A few months before this, a few months before Khrushchev's visit, Richard Nixon, who was then vice president, was in Russia. He was in the Soviet Union. And this was the occasion for the famous kitchen debate that I expect people will have heard something about. Did that help to say, you write about that in a book, did that help to set the stage then for Khrushchev's trip here?
Yes, it did. And when Nixon was sent to Russia, he had no idea that Ike was going to invite Khrushchev. He was just going to be the host at an American exhibition that was taking place in a park in Moscow. And the day that he left, Ike summoned him to the White House and told him, oh, by the way, I've invited Khrushchev to the United States, and he has accepted, and he'll be coming in the fall. And Nixon was angry that he hadn't been told and somewhat flummoxed, because it was 1959. Nixon was going to run for president in 1960. And so he knew there would be enormous coverage of his trip to Moscow, and he knew he had to show the Americans that he could stand up to Khrushchev, as the phrase of the day had it. But Ike told him, look, this guy's coming over here, don't rattle his cage. Not in those words, but basically that was the message. You know, go easy on him. Don't even mention this trip to the United States. So Nixon was in a bit of a bind, the poor man, and he went to Russia. He couldn't sleep on the way over. He couldn't sleep when he got there. He was very nervous. And then he took Khrushchev on a stroll through the American exhibit, and that's where they had their famous kitchen debate.
And this, just for people who may not remember this, as part of this exhibit, what was said to be a model, state-of-the-art American kitchen for 1959. And they use that as an opportunity to debate the various merits of the two economic systems why. And, of course, Nixon was wanting to make the case why democracy and capitalism were the best. And he was standing there and pointing at all these great, shiny, glorious things like refrigerators and dishwashers, saying, well, this shows you what our kind of economic system can do.
Yes, and Khrushchev lied through his teeth and said, oh, yeah, we do the same. Khrushchev refused to yield a point on anything. So if he had to engage in a little exaggeration, he would do that. But the debate became famous, and there was also on the same day prior to that a debate which was televised. The kitchen debate was not, but there was a RCA exhibit at which there was a video camera. And Khrushchev and Nixon were supposed to record greetings, and they did. But Khrushchev, being Khrushchev, he was a very he was a ham, basically. And so he started baiting Nixon, and the two of them had a little set to in front of the TV cameras. And that's what many Americans have seen, because those videos were shown on TV a million times and are still around. You can see them on YouTube. That wasn't the kitchen debate. That was maybe an hour before the kitchen debate. But all these instances became famous and really helped Nixon, actually, in his quest to become president.
And this, I guess one of the little details in this that I really like and I think is interesting is that William Safire was along on this trip, and he apparently was the one who steered them into the kitchen where this took place.
Right. William Safire was a young PR man at the time, and he was representing a home builder of the kind of typical home that I grew up in, which would be about a $14,000 house, a little suburban house, a kind of a starter house in those days, although I grew up with it for my entire childhood. Anyway, it was a modest suburban ranch house, and it had this kitchen, which was a typical American kitchen, really. And he saw Nixon and Khrushchev coming, trailed by a pack of reporters. And there was a fence in front of this house, and he tied a chain to it and the other end of the chain to a car and pulled it down and then said, step right this way into a typical American house. And Nixon and Khrushchev stepped in. The press followed them. And then Safire, who was very savvy, had his aide let Russians in from the other door. So Nixon and Khrushchev were really trapped inside his house. And they went on to their famous debate there.
We talked a little bit earlier about how once the invitation was made, a lot of conservatives in America were angry with the president, with Mr. Eisenhower, for issuing the invitation. And there were people publicly expressing threats against Mr. Khrushchev, and that J. Edgar Hoover said they were tens of thousands of people who would like to see him dead. What's also interesting is that a lot of people, perhaps, well, I don't know if more people, but certainly a lot of people, instead of wishing him ill, said, well, great. No, have the guy come over. We'd like to have the guy over to our house. And apparently a lot of people thought this was actually a good thing for him to come to the United States and be able to see what America was really like.
Yeah, that was. I had a lot of fun in the National Archives looking at all the letters that had been written to the president and the State Department from people all over America inviting Khrushchev to their town or to their house or to their business, their supermarket, their school, their lodge meeting. They were great. And a lot of this book, it's not really a diplomatic history of the book. It's kind of a portrait of two people, Khrushchev and two characters, Khrushchev and the United States. And the United States is wonderfully revealed in all its kind of goofy glory in these letters of people inviting, thinking Khrushchev would want to come to the Apple Festival at some town in Minnesota and asking, saying, if you want to have a float in the parade, please let us know. I mean, it's just hilarious to read them. But Americans, you know, Americans are optimistic and they love their country and they really honestly believe that if anybody comes here and sees us as we really are, they'll like us. And I think actually they were right. Khrushchev kind of did like us.
And at the same time, you have to say here that Americans, another thing that they like to do is if they see the opportunity to make a buck, they will take advantage of that. And there were a lot of people who thought, who had businesses, who had products to sell and promote, who thought, oh, this is a great opportunity.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah, of course. There's always that. And everybody from a hotel that invited him in Atlantic City and offered him the penthouse suite and a Japanese houseboy to Jimmy Driftwood, a famous country singer of the day, who wrote a song to the tune of The Bear Comes Over the Mountain about the trip and ended up standing in front of the UN with a stuffed bear singing the song to promote it. So everywhere he went, the wonderful American quality of shameless self-promotion was visible. So that was also part of the comedy of the trip. You had the collision of a communist dictator and this country full of politicians and businessmen and hustlers of various sorts trying to horn in on this because it was such a big media event.
Yeah. President Eisenhower, when Khrushchev got here, he, even after the invitation had been issued, he knew he was kind of stuck. But it's funny that when Khrushchev got here, it seemed like right from the very beginning, Khrushchev knew that he was intending to have a good time and to enjoy himself and to enjoy the situation. So right from the beginning, he seemed to be having a good time, and President Eisenhower did not.
Yes, that's true. Ike believed that his goal was to get some kind of an agreement on Berlin. And he thought of this as a diplomatic trip. Khrushchev, I think from the beginning or before he got here, knew that this was a big publicity stunt for him, that he was going to travel around this great country. And get, for one thing, he was very... he felt the Soviet Union did not get its true worth in the international press. And the United States was the top dog on the planet, and he wanted to show that he was equal with them. So it was for him, it was a big TV show, a big propaganda show of him, the personification of communism, traveling around the most powerful country in the world and showing that he was equal to it. So I think he, from the beginning, knew that it was a massive publicity stunt, whereas the Americans did not quite grasp that until at least a few days in.
I'm sure the Americans were figuring that what he would do is sort of like the standard stuff. He would go to the White House, and the president would have him to Camp David, which he actually did, although that didn't come until all the way at the end. I don't know whether what they had in mind or what they thought would happen when they asked him what it was he would like to do. That is, the United States asked Khrushchev what it was he would like to do. And when, you know, Khrushchev said, well, I want to do this and that and the other, what was the reaction of the government to the itinerary that Khrushchev had proposed?
Well, it was funny because the lower-level aides of each leader were negotiating the scheduling. And, of course, being bureaucrats, they were finally attuned to what they thought their bosses wanted. So Khrushchev had instructed his guys that he wanted absolute maximum pomp and stuff that was due to a leader of a great nation, and that he wanted to see New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco. All the Russians loved San Francisco. Of course, everybody loves San Francisco. And so that's what his aides were angling for. Ike had said in the press conference that he wanted the premier to go to his hometown of Abilene, Kansas, so he could see how hard Ike had worked as a child, because Khrushchev had said something snide about how Nixon had never worked hard as a child. So Ike said, I want him to see where I lived and how hard I worked. So Khrushchev had no desire whatever to go to Kansas. So they had to sort of wiggle their way out of that. And the way they did was pretty funny. The Soviets announced or sent a letter saying that, well, you know, President Eisenhower said that he had worked hard and that he wanted Khrushchev to show Khrushchev that he hadn't. Of course, we believe the president, so we don't have to go to this. So Ike also wanted to take Khrushchev up in a helicopter and show him the... basically, from the air, rush hour traffic in Washington and show him basically the average workers getting in their personal cars and driving to their personal homes in the suburbs. And the Soviets kept saying, no, 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 Khrushchev doesn't want to waste his time on a helicopter ride. And this baffled the Americans a bit. And then when Khrushchev arrived, and he's sitting with Ike in a limousine driving from the airport to Washington, and Ike said, gee, it's too bad, you know, you keep saying you don't want to go on this helicopter ride. I'd love to take you up in my helicopter and show you this. And Khrushchev said, oh, you're going to be on the helicopter. Oh, okay, well, if you're going to be in it, sure, I'll go. And Ike realized that Khrushchev was afraid that he would be sent up in a helicopter and there would be some, you know, non-accidental accident and he would plunge to his death. And Ike remembered that right after World War II, when Ike, of course, was the American general, there was a Russian general named Zhukov who had asked Ike for the use, or Ike had offered the use of one of his planes. And Zhukov said, Will you send your son as my aide? And Ike said, sure. And Zhukov said to him, well, with your airplane and your son aboard, I know that I will be safe. So Ike realized what was going on here. These guys were paranoid. They had lived under Stalin when people mysteriously disappeared in little accidents. And so they were afraid. So Ike did end up taking Khrushchev on a helicopter ride. And Khrushchev enjoyed it thoroughly and ordered three helicopters, just like Ike's.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And we're also pleased to be talking this morning with Peter Carlson. He's a former reporter and feature writer for The Washington Post, also worked for The Boston Herald American and for People magazine. And he is the author of a newly published book, K Blows Top, a Cold War comic interlude starring Nikita Khrushchev, America's most unlikely tourist. And this is about the trip that Khrushchev made here to the United States 50 years ago. It was in September of that year in 1959. He spent 2 weeks traveling around the United States, and it's a very great, unusual, crazy story, published by Public Affairs Books, and the book is out now. Well, I want to talk about it a little bit, about some of the things that happened various places along the line. He started out in Washington, was welcomed by the president, then from there went to New York, and here, I guess, did some rhetorical battling with some of America's big capitalists. What was the New York stop like?
Well, it was he was greeted by huge crowds in the streets, and New York went pretty well, except he had a temper tantrum when asked a question about censorship in the Soviet Union. He got a little peeved at that. He threw three or four temper tantrums during the trip, some real and some faked, but that was one of them. And then he went up to Hyde Park and laid a wreath on the grave of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, saw Mrs. Roosevelt a bit, came back down. He made a speech at the UN in which he advocated complete disarmament of everything within 4 years, which was astonishing, of course, and everyone figured it was a propaganda ploy, and of course it was a propaganda ploy. He also, being Khrushchev, he took a little tour. He went to the top of the Empire State Building. He claimed he wasn't very impressed. And he met then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller, who was, of course, a symbol of capitalism, as Khrushchev was a symbol of communism. And the two of them posed for photographers, pretending to be boxing each other. It just one of the many instances in which what was supposed to be a sort of somber diplomatic mission became sort of zany vaudeville comedy. There's a lot of zany comedy in the book, and that was one of them. And then from there he flew to Hollywood.
And this was to go back just again to the title of the book. This was the scene of the blowing of the top that is referred to in the newspaper headline when. Apparently, part of the deal was that he was going to go to Disneyland, wanted to go to Disneyland, and that the local police there said, look, we're sorry, but we just can't. The security here is just too much. We can't do that. And he got very upset when he was told that he couldn't go. Apparently, his wife and children could have gone, but he couldn't go.
Well, they being the American authorities, never actually offered that possibility. And I don't know whether Khrushchev's wife and daughters would have accepted that or not, but they never offered that. What The Disneyland trip was sort of arranged haphazardly. Khrushchev's plane was in the air on the way to Los Angeles when Henry Cabot Lodge, who was our ambassador to the UN, who was kind of Khrushchev's tour guide, he realized that they didn't have anything planned after this big luncheon with the Hollywood stars. So he called the police chief from the plane and said, hey, chief, what should we do after this thing? And the chief said, well, you could go to Disneyland or you could take a drive through some housing developments. And so Lodge asked Khrushchev, and Khrushchev asked his wife, and she said, I want to go to Disneyland. So he said, I want to go to Disneyland. Mm-hmm. He really had no idea what Disneyland was. And so they were going to go, but as Khrushchev's motorcade went from the airport in Los Angeles to 20th Century Fox Studios, somebody on the street threw a rotten tomato at Khrushchev's car, and it missed, but it hit the police chief's car. And the police chief said later that that taught him that, quote, not all the Indians were happy. So he told Lodge in the middle of the luncheon, you know, like, I will not be responsible for Khrushchev's security in Disneyland. So Lodge said, well, if you're not going to be responsible, we don't go. We'll do something else. And Khrushchev's ambassador to the United States, a guy they used to call Smiling Mike Menshikov, overheard this. And he went and tattled to Khrushchev, and Khrushchev got mad. And threw this tantrum, a very funny tantrum, actually, about why he couldn't go to Disneyland.
This whole appeal of Disneyland, I've never quite been able to get myself. I'm thinking here again about something that you mentioned. We talked earlier about the piece that you wrote in the Post about how talking about this visit and then setting up this sort of parallel, saying, well, why not have Barack Obama invite Kim Jong-il? And at the end, you note that in 2001, Kim Jong-il's oldest son was arrested trying to get into Japan on a fake passport, and apparently he said, I wanted to go to Disneyland. What is the deal with Disneyland? I don't quite get it.
Well, you know, I guess communist dictators, like most Americans and maybe most people all over the world, want to see Disneyland. Maybe for the same reason that, you know, my kids badgered me until I took them. And actually, at the time when Khrushchev threw his little tantrum, there were a lot of people in the press who said, well, yeah, of course he wants to go to Disneyland. You know, who would go to Los Angeles without seeing Disneyland? And later on, some commentators suggested that he threw that tantrum just to get sympathy from the American public because he figured they would sympathize with the plight of a man who wasn't allowed to go to Disneyland, which was completely absurd because he really didn't know anything about Disneyland and had no idea the esteem it had in the hearts of American school children. But it made for quite a lot of back and forth among the pundits of the day.
Yeah. We have a caller here. Let's bring him into the conversation. Line one in Champaign right here. Hello.
Hello. I just wanted to call and say I'm so happy to hear about this trip of Gorbachev's because when I was a child in Seneca, Illinois, LaSalle County, Khrushchev came to visit a pig farm, the Holderman Pig Farm, about a half mile, 2 miles maybe outside of east of Seneca. And I've told my kids this story, and they think I'm nuts, but honest to God, he was there looking at pigs in Seneca, Illinois. That's all I had to say.
All right. Well, I don't know. Do you know about that?
I hate to disappoint this lady, but Khrushchev never went to Illinois. She mentioned Gorbachev earlier. Maybe Gorbachev went. That I don't know. But Khrushchev did visit a farm, but it was in Iowa, and but he never went to Illinois at all. And the farm in Iowa was basically a corn farm. He did go to Iowa State University, where he visited the Ag College had a pig breeding center, and he did go there. But he never went to a farm in Illinois.
Okay. Well, I don't know. Is the caller still there? Is the girl still there?
Uh-huh.
So you remember having seen...
I remember people telling the story. And Gorbachev, when was that, in the 70s?
Okay, so probably this was not Nikita Khrushchev, it was Mikhail Gorbachev.
No, this happened in the 50s when I was a small girl. in the 50s. They told this story.
Well, it sounds like maybe it was just a story.
It sounds like it was a story.
Maybe it just they just got the geography wrong, because he did visit a farm here, and it was very highly publicized.
Huh.
It was another of the zany events of the trip, but that occurred in Iowa.
It was Iowa.
Okay. The
All
people
right.
in Seneca had the story wrong then. Thank you.
Well, it's interesting, though, that, who knows, maybe there are people elsewhere who are talking about the fact that he was there in their town that where he never actually showed up.
Well, it's funny. There are a lot of myths that have grown up about Khrushchev. The event most Americans remember about Khrushchev is that he banged his shoe on a desk at the UN. And maybe they also remember that he once said, "We will bury you," and that he was not allowed to go to Disneyland. So those are about the three things most mm-hmm. Americans know about Khrushchev. And a lot of Americans have sort of combined the two, that he wasn't allowed to go to Disneyland, so he banged his shoe at the UN and said, "We will bury you." But actually, the events occurred, all three of them, in different years. And many Americans believe that they saw on TV Nikita Khrushchev banging his shoe at the UN. But he was never shown banging his shoe. The only picture that exists of it shows the shoe on his desk after he finished banging it. So I think what happens is that the phrase "Khrushchev banging his shoe at the UN" is so vivid that people conjure the picture up in their mind, and they kind of think that they actually saw it.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't.
And this was the shoe banging thing. This was maybe a little bit more than a year later than the events that we're talking about here.
Right. I cover it in the book. The book has three trips in it. One is Nixon's trip to Moscow, where the kitchen debates took place. The second is the bulk of the book, which is the trip we're talking about in 1959 across the United States. And then the third, also shorter, is when he came back and in a very bad mood because of the U2 incident. And that is when he banged his shoe at the UN. That would be October of 1960.
And then it was another 2 years, October 62. That was the Cuban Missile Crisis. And then by October of 1964, Khrushchev was removed from power. So this is a relatively short period of time here. Things really turned sour, tensions heightened, and then just 4 years later, he was out of a job.
Right.
Other questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Peter Carlson, former reporter, feature writer for the Washington Post, and has authored this book about the visit of Nikita Khrushchev to the United States 50 years ago. The title of his book is K Blows Top, published by Public Affairs. Tell us more about the Iowa visit. That's the farm visit. I'm sure that's something that people around here can associate with.
Well, Khrushchev knew at least one American farmer, and that was a guy by the name of Roswell Garst, who was from Coon Rapids, Iowa, and was a millionaire farmer and corn hybridizer, if that's the correct word. And he, Garst, was another larger-than-life character, just like Khrushchev, a master salesman and a guy who knew a lot about corn and thought that corn could save the world by feeding everybody. He went to the Soviet Union a few years before Khrushchev came here and lectured about corn, and Khrushchev, as it happened, was also a corn freak. He wanted to plant corn all over the Soviet Union, in places where they had never grown it before. He thought that could really boost their agriculture. So he sat with Garst for a long night of eating and drinking and listening to Garst's wisdom about corn, and he bought 5,000 tons of hybrid seed corn from Garst. Garst then went back to Russia again, and they met again. So they were pretty good friends. And when Ike invited Khrushchev here, Khrushchev immediately said, "I want to go to Iowa and see my friend Garst's farm." So by the time they got to Iowa, they'd already been in Hollywood. They'd been in San Francisco and New York. And Garst realized that it was a crazy media mob scene. There were hundreds of reporters trailing Khrushchev wherever he went. And Garst really wanted to show Khrushchev the nuts and bolts of how his farm worked. So he met Khrushchev at a dinner before Khrushchev was supposed to go to the farm, and he said, "Look, why don't you sneak away from your handlers, and just bring your translator. And at 6:30 in the morning, sneak out of the hotel. I'll pick you up, and we'll go to the farm, and we won't have this big mob scene. And Khrushchev said he couldn't do that. Khrushchev later said in his memoirs that that would have been like a bride kidnapped in the Caucasus. So they couldn't do that. And so Khrushchev did go to the farm, but trailed by this ridiculous media mob scene. And when they got there, Garst was not thrilled to watch these hundreds of reporters trampling his crops and just getting in the way of what he wanted to show Khrushchev. So he got really mad, and he pulled a corn stalk out of the ground and jabbed it at the photographers. At another point, he said, "If you don't move back, I'm gonna kick you back." And he kicked Harrison Salisbury of the New York Times in the shins, and he started picking up wet silage and throwing it at the photographers. Khrushchev just stood there laughing. It was a very bizarre scene. But poor Garst just wanted to show this man his farm, and the reporters were getting in the way.
This points out one of the features of this trip, things that, aside from the historic nature of the trip, in some people's minds, sets its place in history, and that it maybe was, if not the first, one of the first big modern kind of media events, in the sense that there was a huge mob of reporters. They trailed Mr. Khrushchev everywhere he went. It made huge news. This was an enormous media event. Maybe we're used to that kind of thing now, but at the time, there probably hadn't really ever been anything like this before.
Well, there had been media mob scenes before. For instance, the Lindbergh kidnapping trial was covered by hundreds and hundreds of reporters. But this was the first of the TV age traveling media roadshows that went on for days and days and days. And the day after that sort of riot on Garst's farm, Scotty Reston, who was a very important columnist in the New York Times and who was there, he wrote a column that sort of predicted what was to happen in the future and the media mob scenes that we now take for granted. And he said, I'm quoting here now, "There are so many newsmen reporting this trip that they change the course of events. They are not the obscure witnesses of history, but the principal characters in the drama, whose very presence is so ubiquitous that most of the time Mr. Khrushchev is addressing them or addressing others with them in mind." The first time that somebody that important as Reston was announced that basically the media was now as important as politicians.
Well, and that seemed to be something that in some way Khrushchev understood, at least that this was his opportunity to perhaps not just talk to the people of the United States, maybe he wasn't thinking about that, but to, in a sense, talk to the people of the world.
Yes, I think he thought of himself as a dynamic new leader of what he thought was the dynamic new system of government, communism. And his trip he saw as an advertisement for himself and his system, whereas the Americans, as I said earlier, kind of thought it was a diplomatic mission. But he knew it was a TV show advertising him. So nowadays we would understand that, I think, partially because of this trip. Dan Shore, who is, of course, an NPR commentator now, was on the trip. He was he had been a Moscow correspondent for CBS. And he said it was the first of the big media mob scenes. And the TV and radio were just learning how to do this at the time. So now they've learned. Now we don't have a trip like this. We could never possibly have a foreign leader, particularly an adversary, traveling around the country for 14 days. It would never happen, probably because of the importance of the media and because of what this trip showed about how crazy things could get.
7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest, Peter Carlson, he's former reporter and feature writer for The Washington Post, and he is the author of a book about this visit of Nikita Khrushchev to the United States happened 50 years ago. K Blows Top is the title of the book. Public Affairs is the publisher. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, after all of this, after more than a week of this, Khrushchev goes back to Washington for the official meeting with the president, and they go to Camp David and spend the weekend there talking. Did anything important in regards to the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union, anything important come out of that?
Well, it seemed at the time that something important had come out of it. No great treaty was signed, but Khrushchev and Ike agreed to convene a summit in Paris the next spring with Khrushchev, Eisenhower, de Gaulle of France, and Macmillan of England to solve the problem of Berlin. And Ike agreed that he would visit the Soviet Union also in the spring of 1960. Then Khrushchev flew home, and he announced to a huge crowd that Ike was a good guy, he was a wise statesman, and he wanted peace, that there were some people over here who wanted the Cold War, but he believed that his friend Eisenhower did not and that he could be dealt with. And that was all very nice rhetoric. But Khrushchev also reduced his military by over 1 million men and reduced his military budget. And so it looked like at the time that the Cold War was easing up a bit. Unfortunately, what happened next is that the United States sent a U-2 plane, a spy plane, over the Soviet Union, and the Soviets shot it down. This would be May 1st, 1960. And Khrushchev got really mad, and he trapped Eisenhower into coming up with a bogus cover story, and then he brought forth the pilot from the U-2, who he had not announced was still alive. The Americans thought the pilot, Gary Powers, was dead. And so they concocted this ridiculous story about it being a weather plane. So after the Americans put forth that cover story, Khrushchev produced Powers and showed his pictures of Soviet military installations and proved that the Americans were lying. So he then went and sabotaged the conference in Paris, and he uninvited Ike to the Soviet Union. And obviously we'd gone way, way back in terms of progress toward detente. Mm-hmm. And then Khrushchev decided to stick his thumb in the eyes of the Americans by appointing himself head of the Soviet delegation to the UN. And he came back to the United States as an uninvited guest in the fall of 1960, and just made a big pain of himself at the UN for almost a month in October of 1960.
And this was for people who will recall it, this was the occasion of the shoe banging.
It was indeed, yes. And all this took place in the middle of the presidential campaign between Nixon and Kennedy, which was, of course, very, very close. And there was Khrushchev in the middle trying to make as much trouble as he could in New York.
It really, it's sad. It seemed like it was a missed opportunity, perhaps, that it seemed to go well enough, the meeting between Eisenhower and Khrushchev, and Khrushchev certainly seemed to think that Eisenhower was a reasonable man that he could deal with, and then there was this invitation for Eisenhower to go to the Soviet Union for a kind of a parallel visit. Apparently, Khrushchev was so concerned with making Eisenhower feel at home, he actually built a golf course so that Ike, when he was there, could play golf?
Yes, the Soviet Union's first golf course, and Ike's granddaughter, Susan, assures me that she has seen it. She's married to a Russian. She has seen it. It's still there. He built a whole little vacation house and golf course that I could play at. But alas, it wasn't to be. The whole gist of the book shows us, I think, that we are sometimes ruled by wise men, but all human beings are flawed, and lurking inside all or most human beings is a, you know, tempestuous 2-year-old or 8-year-old or maybe 12-year-old who pops out on occasion. And Khrushchev certainly fits that bill, as did many of the Americans that he ran into. So what's really scary is that these little not quite grown-up 2-year-olds have their fingers on the nuclear button. And that's what made, I tried to capture the feel of the era. And I grew up in that era. And I remember how scary it was, a combination of scary and funny, in which you would be, there were drills in which you would crouch under your desk with your hands over your head in preparation for nuclear attack. And, you know, even in second grade, we knew that was not going to help us if a bomb fell nearby, but we sort of had to do it. And what I hope to capture in the book was the feel of America in the 50s and this sort of partially scary, partially funny milieu that we were growing up in at the time.
Yeah. Let's try to get one more caller here. We have somebody in Chicago on our toll-free line. Yeah. Line 4, hello.
What you said about Khrushchev not wanting a Cold War and the Nixon-Kennedy election debates and all that, we had the missile crisis in Cuba, and on the basis of some people in the so-called best and brightest wanted to confront Khrushchev and Russia. There was one that would decided that the relationship with Khrushchev could be more amicable, and told Kennedy that he felt that if he personally contacted Khrushchev, he would be able to deal with him, knowing that Khrushchev didn't want a Cold War, as he was said about with Eisenhower, acknowledging, and that prevailed over the minds of the so-called best and brightest that were arraigned at the time to try to deal with the Cuban Missile Crisis. So too bad we haven't had some of the best and brightest dealing with the situation that got us into Iraq. So I thought I'd mention that the relationship of Khrushchev with Kennedy, speaking to him personally and sort of calming down the intensity of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Thank you.
Okay. Well, you want to say something about that?
Well, the Cuban Missile Crisis was, we came very, very close to nuclear war. My colleague at the Washington Post, Michael Dobbs, recently published a book about it. And I knew at the time, I was 10, and I was scared to death. And I knew that we had come close. But if you read his book, you realize we came even closer than we thought. At one point, Americans were dropping depth charges on a nuclear Soviet nuclear submarine that had missiles that could have sent firing towards the United States, but the Soviet commander sort of said, well, let's wait a minute. And then he managed to stop it. We also had a U-2 was lost over the Soviet Union during the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. I didn't know that either. It was even scarier than we thought, and we thought it was pretty damn scary at the time.
Well, you know, we're at the point we're just going to have to stop, and I just would say that it's a great story that you tell, and if folks want to read it, they should look for the book. The title is K Blows Top, A Cold War Comic Interlude Starring Nikita Khrushchev, America's Most Unlikely Tourist. It's about this period of 2 weeks that Khrushchev spent in the United States 50 years ago, 1959. It's published by Public Affairs by our guest, Peter Carlson. He's former reporter and feature writer for The Washington Post. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you, David.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives, the show first broadcast July 7th. More Focus programs, interviews from the Afternoon Magazine, our local production, available on our website. Go to will.illinois.edu. Programs here on WILL made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting El Nora the Guitar Festival, September 10th through the 12th. More information on this event at krannertcenter.com. We are WILL, and WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. We'll take a break here, as we usually do, so we can bring you an update on the news and on the markets, so please stay tuned.
Support for Illinois Public Media comes from Syngenta, featuring AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids, designed to give you up to 38 bushels more per acre if you have rootworms, and an average of 3 more even if you don't. More information on Syngenta's AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids is at agrisuretraits.com.
Let's take a look at the numbers in Kansas City. First of all, September wheat trading at 490, that's down 10 cents. December at 505 and three quarters, down 11 and three quarters. And March at 521, down 12. In Chicago, September wheat at 456 and three quarters, down 10 and a quarter. December at 485 and a half, down 9 and three quarters. And March at 504 and three quarters, down 10. September corn 320, down 1. December 325, down 4. March 338 and a quarter, down 4 and a half. May 346 and three quarters, down 4 and three quarters. And July 2010 at 354 and a quarter, down 5 and three quarters. September soybeans at $11.75, down 35. November at 973 and a quarter, down 37 and three quarters. January 974 and a quarter, down 37 and a half. March at 971 and a quarter, down 36. May 965 and a quarter, down 34. And July at 967 and a half, down 33. September soybean meal.